Okay, I'm going to call the work session to order. Note that we are all here save Councillor Collette, who is excused. And the first item of business on our agenda is the Chief Operating Officer's communication.
Now, President Hughes, councilors, I just a few items for you. You did receive an email earlier today from your Property and Environmental Services Director Paul Simon regarding the status of our solid waste operations. I just want to reiterate that I-84 is closed, of course, and we are rerouting trucks. We have some of them now going directly to Pallets County, but there are still other trucks being routed over Mount Hood on 26 and 35. So, pretty long route for them, but we're getting stuff moved, and the situation is reasonably under control. Expectation is that I-84 won't open, reopen again for at least 3 more days. It's the current state of this point. So. Also, Oxbow Park is closed as well as Blue Lake, so that's for our primary customer as well as staff safety. So those operations have been impacted, and the only other one is Expo has a re-roofing project, and we've pulled contractors off of that project for now.
I was wondering about Oxbow. Is its proximity for fire threat? Is it in the level one area, or is it in a 2-3 area?
It's a level one area currently. Again, with wind shifts, it very easily could shift to something else. Also, that's just Oxbow because of the nature of the location. The entry location, as well as the camping being on the back end of that park, it's a hard area to evacuate from if you were needing to do so in rapid fire fashion. So, out of extreme caution, we basically have asked campers to vacate the area.
But we still have staff?
We do not have staff at Oxbow Park other than security staff, just maintaining a very basic presence. But they've all been to the Lake Park.
Okay.
And so they're just checking on it.
Okay. Outside. All right. Thank you for that reassurance.
Betcha. Second, just to let you know, the draft access master plan for Chehalem Ridge Needed Park is open for a couple of comments out there. So while you're on Metro Parks and Nature open that draft access master plan for review and public comment. The comment period is open until midnight Tuesday, September 12th. So if you have parties you want to make sure are touching that particular draft master plan, you might want to use your social media channels or elsewise to encourage that. The executive summary as well as the survey was translated into Spanish, and we're trying to help as many people as possible provide public comment. After the comment period closes, part of the time we'll make final revisions to the plan. They'll ready for presentation to you. And then the proposed date for adoption is October 19th. So that would be the off-site meeting for the Department of Planning for Forest Grove at the community center. So that's the current path forward there. Again, another very important milestone for parks in the future. And then last but not least, I just wanted to thank Councillor Dirksen and Colette here, in particular, but all of you for your support for Expo and Cirque du Soleil. We had an opportunity to attend the VIP event. I just want to let you know that while it's obviously still running through October 9th, but that the early turnout has been great. They've been running about 90% of capacity, which is making the CERC folks extremely happy. They've served over 10,000 people in terms of just parking alone. So they're really getting a great, great turnout, which is perfect. So you do have an opportunity to attend if you haven't through October 9th. We encourage you to do so. It's quite a fun event. So.
Is part of the turnout advantage because of the expo and ability to handle a lot of people, then hopefully that will keep them wanting to come back to expo instead of other locations?
They've been extremely pleased with expo as a location, primarily because they have a dedicated portion of the parking facility. I will say that the expo staff are extremely flexible and creative in terms of helping make sure that that flows smoothly. This weekend will be their biggest challenge, but they're ready for it. Matthew Rusher guarantees me that they're ready to go, but it's got the RV show in the facility at the same time as Cirque du Soleil. So they'll be moving folks, they'll be shuttle busing, and all sorts of things. But they have a very strong plan together, but that has definitely. Cirque is extremely pleased with Expo's location. I think, I won't say we're guaranteed future business, but we certainly have a good prospect of it.
It's already returning business.
Yeah, this is the second round for them.
Right.
So,
Actually, you did make a comment at the VIP event that kind of alluded to future.
I would love to comment more on that, but I am okay. Not ready to do so at this time.
All right.
Yeah. That concludes my comments, unless you have questions.
Sure, go ahead.
I have a question regarding the new restaurant coming into Glendevere. Are we able to announce that yet? I mean, ask a lot of questions about it.
We are not announcing the party yet, but the fact that lease has been, the existing lease with Ringside, I should say, is being turned over to a secondary party at this point. I can say that it is a food lineup that's probably more commensurate with that neighborhood. It's a little more in the middle range. And so it will be announced very soon. We just have a few more details for you.
Other questions? Scott? Okay. Work session topic today is regional funding and investment opportunities for equitable housing. And we have attracted a fairly substantial audience to hear about that stuff. And a distinguished panel of experts.
And now that's half the solution.
Yep. So, yeah, just cut to the solution and, you know, don't bother us with it.
I'm just going to try and get over the time. You're in the corner.
Okay, you got us back down the corner.
We are also here to talk about potential future business. I think that's just a great segue into the conversation about Metro's role in providing regional solutions for affordable housing. As you know, we have been doing a lot of work on affordable housing over the last 3 years, and we've been doing that in the military for 3 years. And so we kind of want to give you an update. It has been about 6 months since we've had a work session on this particular part of our work program. It would not be a work session that I let off if we do not have a treat on it. But in this case, I think it's important because we're going to be seeing a lot of the planning department coming up this fall. It's that time of year when we do have a lot of policy and other related projects coming your way. And this tree does symbolize sort of the different ways we intersect with our work. The tree is the roots of the policy, so things like the urban growth decision and RTP. This trunk is where we put our money where our mouth is, our programs and investments to actually accomplish the outcomes that are growing out of the tree. So talking about housing today is really kind of a trunk moment where we're actually talking about taking the policy aspirations and goals we have and trying to figure out how we can invest in making them produce the outcomes that we all hope they will. The other graphic on here is one that you'll start getting to know as well, in which the hypothesis that in order to accomplish the 2040 vision, we are essentially stewards of regional livability. We have a responsibility in multiple areas to protect livability as our region changes and grows. And we all know land and infrastructure is one of our main responsibilities. We know that regulations and policies are one of the ways we really protect livability. We've seen funding and financing grow as a tool that we are able to use in order to bring those others about, and I think we've now started to see a shift in our best practices toward also investing in community capital as one of the pieces of managing and responding to growth and change. So this work around equitable housing is very much in line with the evolution of what we're trying to do in order to accomplish the future of the 2040 vision. And what I want to say is, in the last 3 years, our housing efforts have changed significantly. So starting in 2015, we've led that process that culminated in that report that really provides all the foundation for the work that's gone forward, many of you over the summer. Last fall, you guys authorized us to launch a pilot round on the equitable housing grant, so taking some of our CET funds and focusing specifically on equitable housing. Thanks, guys. Also, I think you remember we got a grant from DEQ. We started to build a small coalition, which we handed that over, and now Molly is working on that. You'll hear more about the summit coming up this fall. But one of the things that we talked about with you last fall is, what is the way that Metro can play a role in advancing a regional investment solution? And so that's really what we wanted to talk about today. We had, at that time in the fall, sort of a wide range of things that we do in the funnel. What can we do and how can we do it? And today, based on some research that we're going to walk you through, I think we're getting to a more focused set of choices for us to consider. But also, housing is not just work that Emily is now doing. In addition to this, we have a number of things that are happening in the planning department, and I'm actually really excited to participate in this new city, which is, for example, the TUB program has expanded its focus on affordable housing. So I think we're all proud to say that we have over 800 units of affordable housing in the pipeline right now for affordable units. And if you look back on the history of the entire TUB program, 16 years, something like that, we've only built 729 affordable units. So we're already more than doubled in the pipeline what we've done over the history of the program. So we've really changed our efforts around transit-oriented development. We've got a large grant from the federal government to look at equitable development in Southwest Corridor, and we are doing a ton of work with a wide range of community partners that could serve as a model for things that we can do at a regional scale. You also might know a little thing called growth management, where we're also looking at sort of changing the way we help local jurisdictions achieve their goals around equitable housing and development. And you're going to hear about that one next week. We're about to announce the next round of 2040 grants that we would like to recommend, in which you also set a target for equitable housing and equity outcomes. And so you can see that this work is permeating through the work that we're doing in community and development in many ways. Oh, and also our regional snapshot program will, again, this fall focus on housing, and particularly some of the work that's been happening with a small coalition. And the last thing I'll mention is that this kind of work also presents opportunities to think about how we advance Metro's strategy around racial equity. And so what are the opportunities programmatically on what we do with housing to also intersect there? And that's a policy conversation we want to continue to have with you over time. So, I'm still saying that. I'm old, I can't be talking things. But if you remember nothing about 3 years of the equitable housing work, these are the four things to remember. These were the four sort of categories of work that came out of our foundation equitable housing report, recognizing that, as we all know, there are multiple sets of needs and multiple income levels around the region that play out in many ways, and that for a regional solution and a regional approach, we have to recognize the different types of tools and the different types of approaches that need to be taken in order to accomplish a broader goal. So there will be a pop quiz, and we will recite these at the end of the work session. We do that every day in the planning department.
As you gather for calisthenics,
health outcomes, healthy workplace, we care about it. And so, with that, I really want to let Emily sort of walk through the work we've done, where it leads us, and what we hope to talk with you about.
Since the work session last fall, Alyssa and Annie talked to you about the universe of potential investment tools and funding sources that could be explored. We've done some work to look at what is the market feasibility of those different investment approaches. And we hired a consultant to help us test market feasibility. We pulled together some new data on the need for affordable housing that we have in the highlights in the presentation today. We have a lot more of that data that we're working on synthesizing into a report that we want to share back with local jurisdictions. We did a survey of local funding and incentive tools and had a consultant help us put together an inventory of existing resources for investing in affordable housing. And we had some initial conversations with staff at housing authorities, planning directors, and community development directors just to get some initial local feedback. We've summarized some of that in the memo that you found in the packet. And the memo that we shared with you in the work session packet is, you realize, a lot of technical information. We're not going to get into the weeds of that today. This is going to be pretty high level. We wanted to give you a little more information. This is still preliminary and would need to be refined if we were to develop an actual program. But we wanted to give you the information to be able to have a sense of what the scale of impact might be of different approaches. So this, just going back to all of the program activities that Alyssa mentioned, this just kind of puts them on a timeline for you to show how this work relates to other work we have underway. I think there are a lot of overlaps with the work happening through the Equitable Housing Grant Program. There is work happening at the local level that could be enhanced by a regional strategy. You'll see the Build Small work. Again, we have the summit coming up November 3rd. That really relates to that on the four-part framework, the strategy around increasing supply, and then this strategy, which is looking at a regional planning investment solution for affordable housing. And you'll see that I included on here a line for, so we've got the planning work, which includes stakeholder engagement. We would anticipate the next steps would be a more robust stakeholder engagement process and actual program development. But we also realize that there is a political feasibility portion of that work, and that's where we would want to collaborate with the council and with the government affairs team and with MPAC. So this is initial work that's intended to help start that conversation. So just to share some high-level highlights from the affordable housing means work, and some of these numbers were in the memo that you saw, but this slide shows the need for housing at 0 to 30% of area median income, which is around the salary of a full-time minimum wage worker, slightly adjusted for household size, and you can see that on the left of the side. The two bars in the chart on the left, the bar that's showing the number of households in that income bracket. On the right, you see the number of housing units in that income bracket. And the units are broken down into units that are occupied by a household that is paying no more than 30% of their income on rent, and units by a household that is paying more than what is considered affordable in rent. And then you can see that there's also a very large deficit of units, which is not surprising. This data looks pretty similar in any jurisdiction that you look at across the region. And this one shows for the Free County region that the existing supply and needs for housing at 30 to 50% of area median income, which would be around the salary of a preschool teacher or customer service representative. So there you can see this again is pretty consistent across all of our jurisdictions, a slightly a sizable deficit, but not quite as big as the deficit of deeply affordable housing. And then this is looking at average annual funding for affordable housing. Statistic in your memo that is, I think, a pretty powerful statement that about 94% of the resources for affordable housing in our region are in the city of Portland. Portland has passed several new local funding measures. So if you look at the overall scale of resources, you can see that urban renewal has been a huge source of funding in Portland. The GO bond that passed last year is another large source. You can see a few little slivers of orange in there that are non-Portland. That's primarily federal funding. There's been a little bit of general fund obligation primarily in Multnomah County, and then a little bit of TIF in Beaverton. But by and large, dedicated funding for affordable housing is primarily in And just one other thing I would highlight here is that if you look at affordable housing units, about 33% of units are outside of Portland in the rest of the region. So there is regulated affordable housing that's being supported through federal tax credits and state resources, but there is not the same dedicated local funding. This next slide is from a body of research that's going to be published this month by Dr. Lisa Bates at PSU, looking at naturally occurring affordable housing, so the way she has defined that is looking at CoStar ratings, which is a rating system for private, unsubsidized market housing to look at basically the quality of buildings. So a five-star building would be a luxury apartment, a new luxury apartment building. A one-star building would be a very dilapidated structure that's basically a teardown. If you look at two- and three-star buildings, those are typically either older buildings that would be target for market speculation to do a quick upgrade and kind of mark up the rents. So those are where we really see the risk of displacement. And they're doing, PSU's doing some great work looking at that displacement risk in these buildings that could be used to help inform a strategy focused around preservation of affordability in those buildings. I included this slide because it looks at the recent sales transactions of those of multifamily units. And you can see that more than half of those are in racially diverse census tracts, so more diverse than the average census tract. And of those, more than half of them are those 2- and 3-star buildings that we would consider naturally occurring. So I think there's going to be some really helpful and interesting data coming out of that research that could help inform a strategy around displacement. And so we have had a lot of conversations about the benefits of a regional approach as opposed to a local approach. I think from the conversations I've had around the region, there is widespread recognition of the need for regional coordination. There's more work to be done to understand exactly what that would look like, but there are a lot of jurisdictions around the region looking at local tools and strategies like a construction excise tax, but I think there's a pretty strong recognition that you're not going to be able to do anything on the scale that would have a regional impact without a regionally coordinated solution. Regional approach provides the opportunity to geographically target investments to places that provide the best outcome for vulnerable communities and the most cost efficiency. So if you're looking at a preservation strategy, for example, really targeting to areas where there's a high displacement risk, there's a volatile market where we anticipate market change in the future, being able to coordinate those kinds of investments with our transit and other infrastructure investments. And then being able to develop strategies that fully leverage the existing state and federal resources. There are some underutilized, non-competitive resources that we could tap into more if we had the right funding tools to complement them. And then finally, on the in terms of resource development and revenue generation, being able to spread the burden of generating revenue evenly across the region and capture operational efficiencies of scale. This slide was inspired by Alyssa, who's been really talking about the way we want to frame the strategies that we're going to discuss not as a list of alternatives, but rather as a menu of options that can be customized and tailored to the needs at the local level. So, thinking about how we build deeply affordable housing that addresses the root causes of homelessness, thinking about how we provide shallow subsidies that leverage the private market to capture a little bit of affordability or below market units in market rate development. Looking at investments in land acquisition that capture value from infrastructure investments, and then the naturally occurring affordable housing and anti-displacement strategies. That can also be a strategy for rehabilitation of lower quality buildings. So everything you see that we're going to share today are strategies that we consider to be feasible and recommended as part of a regional program. So this is what we would recommend as the scope of the conversation. We had some local feedback about a few other things to explore, so we'll talk about those later too. But to start with the three strategic elements that that we described in the memo, the first being focused on anti-displacement and community stabilization through two program components. The first would be a land acquisition strategy that would be very similar to what our TOT program currently does, but kind of expanded. So if you think of the furniture, the model that we use for the furniture store property at 82nd and Division, this would be acquiring strategic sites to put out for a competitive bid for affordable housing development in locations that we can offer the best value. This could be coordinated with, obviously, with our transit planning strategies, and we've heard a lot from our Southwest Corridor stakeholders about the need for land acquisition in advance of transit. The second piece is the would be a preservation strategy or an anti-displacement strategy that would be facilitated partnership with nonprofits to acquire and rehab existing naturally occurring affordable housing and preserve the affordability in the long term. And so that is a relatively new area where we still have more of our models emerging around the country, but there's a little more best practice research. We need to fine-tune exactly what that would look like. But being able to have a nimble strategy that that can prevent displacement. So this is kind of a short-term anti-displacement strategy. Land acquisition could be a little bit more of a longer-term strategy. The second strategy is flexible gap financing. So there is any affordable housing, any typical affordable housing project has many different layers of funding in it. There is a growing gap because construction costs are going up. And so when you talk to affordable housing developers and housing authorities about what's needed, gap financing is always at the top of the list. And additional resources, if you want to go deeper than 60% of area median income in an affordable housing project, you need to have some additional resources. Section 8 vouchers are one way to do that, and if there were additional gap financing, that could help support housing authorities and being able to leverage other resources to get a deeper level of affordability. So if you think about what a regional investment program, what impact it could have on homelessness, I think the connection point is really providing that permanently affordable and more deeply subsidized housing. This obviously would be a strategy that would be in partnership with housing authorities and we should also mention that these are not all strategies. I think the TOD program is one that makes a lot of sense operationally. Metro has the capacity to administer a program like that. The other strategies would likely be administered through strong partnerships with local governments and housing authorities, and this is one where that's definitely the case. And then the third strategy, mixed income communities and shallow subsidies. This is targeting primarily private development and how can we get some below market units in otherwise market rate projects using a shallow subsidy approach. So this would hit a lot more units, but the affordability might not be quite so deep, so we might be looking more at an 80% of median income strategy. This would support participation in an inclusionary zoning program in Portland, but also we've been hearing outside of Portland that they're getting a lot more inquiries from developers, permitting offices, about development outside. We anticipate that there's going to be some increased appetite for development outside of Portland. This could help capture some affordability as that happens. And so just to highlight some of the policy considerations, we have some estimates in the memo that we sent out. All of those are really subject to a policy conversation about what is the depth of affordability and the length of affordability of a housing unit. Where are we targeting these investments? There is a difference between a land acquisition in a high-cost market and a low-cost market. What type of housing are we thinking about? An acquisition and preservation strategy could be a more cost-effective approach than new construction, but it also depends on the extent to which that housing is available and for sale. And then finally, what revenue sources might be compatible with the strategies? And so to get to the revenue sources, one thing all of the strategies have in common is that they would require a new revenue source. And these are two. When we came to you in the fall, there was a long list of potential sources, including real estate transfer tax, for example. We've narrowed this to two sources that are compatible with the strategies that we identified and that we think have some near-term feasibility, although there are challenges with any revenue source. So construction excise tax and general obligation bonds. I just wanted to highlight quickly some of the feedback that we heard from local staff. Again, a lot of interest in working together to generate resources on a regional scale. At the same time, there were concerns about fair allocation of resources and strong local participation in further development. So we would anticipate, similar to our CET grant program, to a PERCS to the Parks Fund, that there would be a broad conversation about what is the right formula for an investment program, and how do we partner with local governments. We have heard from staff across the region that councils are asking them to come up with new strategies and to address housing affordability. And as Alyssa mentioned, our new growth management administrative rules are also going to be requiring cities that are interested in doing growth expansions to demonstrate that they're taking steps to address housing affordability. So I think from that standpoint, as staff start to explore what local solutions look like, they very quickly see that the scale of what you're able to do at the local level is not anywhere near suitable to meet the need. There is interest in housing that's affordable at all levels. We heard a lot about the need for homelessness solutions, particularly in Clackamas County. They have the largest increase in homelessness of any county in the state with this most recent point-in-time count. In Beaverton, there's a lot of interest in preservation, and that's what they're using their affordable housing grant from us to look at. In places like Gresham, which have a lot of the naturally occurring affordable housing, I think there could be some interest in a strategy that would both preserve affordability while providing some rehabilitation funding to improve the quality of buildings. But we also heard, and we heard a range. Some cities feel like they have the technical expertise and capacity, but they lack the resources. Other cities feel like they really don't have the knowledge or expertise to do this on their own, and they really need some regional support. We heard about opportunities for coordination with Southwest Corridor, particularly around land acquisition and naturally occurring affordable housing preservation. And then we also heard about the need for that more below-market strategy to, even in areas that where the market is maybe currently at 80%, but they anticipate it to be going up, to capture some affordability now before the market changes. So a kind of shallow subsidy approach, mixed income, slogan approach. And finally, we heard that we also need to look at mobile home park preservation as part of that anti-displacement preservation strategy. Increasing access to home ownership, and so if you, with the construction excise tax, 15% of that is passed through to the state for home ownership assistance, so that is kind of a component of that funding source. And then finally, solutions for homelessness, and we think expanding the supply of permanently affordable housing is the right regional approach. There are other very complicated funding systems in place for services, which there also is not enough services, but we don't think that's an area that really makes sense for metros. So in terms of proposed next steps, we would like to continue to build on this work to develop, to be able to more clearly articulate what these programs might look like. In coordination with that, we recommend some additional political feasibility analysis and talk a little bit more about what that might look like. A racial equity lens needs to be part of this work. So we've had a few conversations at the staff level just talking about what that might look like. And finally, I think engagement is the biggest piece of this. This was intended to be a body work that would help us start a conversation with our regional stakeholder partners. We see impact as key to that conversation, and I'll be going to impact with an update on this work next Wednesday. So what we're really hoping to get direction on today is how we can best work with the council office to and the government affairs team to start that external engagement process. Are there other stakeholders that were not mentioned in the memo or in the list I just showed that need to be part of an engagement process? And how should we be working together on that conversation?
Okay. So, as you look at this last thing, that their request for our discussion, anybody have any response? Go ahead, Craig. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think this is important work, and we hear from all around the region a lack of strategy and a lack of a clear path forward on how to deal with this challenge. But I think before we move any further, I think we need to move further. But before we do, we need to define what our role ought to be. And I think a way to do that is, as you recommend, you've had conversations with local staff, but I think we have to have a conversation with our local partners in the form of MPAT, and have let them help us define. You know, we can talk about what Metro can do, but we need to have them tell us what they think Metro should do. And then based on that, then we would have a path forward to identify what role we can have in this. I have a question on one slide. I want to make sure I understand. On slide number 22, right at the, just up from there, CBO, community-based organization. Okay. What did you, like Community Partners for Affordable Housing, people like that? Great.
Councilor Stacey.
Thanks, Mr. President. I guess I sort of have a historical perspective about this being one of the older members of the council. Chronologically. I greatly appreciate what Councilor Dirksen just said, that we need the guidance and counsel of MPAC and of all our local partners as we try to figure out how to add resources to what is clearly acknowledged across our region, across our state, as a principal problem for livability, for quality of life, for survival of people in our region. I go back to another time when Metro undertook to deal with a subject that was assigned to us by state planning law, protection of natural areas and habitat in the urban region. And Metro staff developed a proposal, which I thought was a great idea, to regulate, to ensure that every suburban community, every part of Portland, had a reasonable regulatory approach to protect habitat as it exists in the developed fabric of the city and the developing fabric. So that would have meant more zoning requirements and responsibilities. That was not appreciated by a whole bunch of folks, including our current president, who was then mayor of one of those local government partners. And working with local government leaders, with advocates for habitat protection, and good staff work, we developed something called the Nature Neighborhoods Program, where instead of telling communities how they had to zone habitat areas, we provided financial assistance to communities, both local governments and community groups that wanted to come up with strategies for protection of habitat and nature. Grants that went from our Metro bonding resource that the voters of the region entrusted us with, under clear standards to ensure that the money wasn't wasted, to deal with and implement objectives around conservation of nature. Here we have a universally acknowledged problem, but we don't have a universally acknowledged expectation that Metro can and should dictate the answers. But what I see being proposed is something very similar to Nature and Neighborhoods, where we would ask our voters, should we invest in solutions to give more households a safe roof over their heads? And should we do that in a way that's collaborative, engages communities, builds trust, and gets good outcomes? Can we have a grant program that puts resources in the hands of communities and CBOs that are doing this kind of work, and ensure that it's done well in order to maintain that trust with our voters and the bond payers? That's the general outline of what I see here. And I really want MPAC, I really want mayors and commissioners around the region to have a role in helping us think that through. I don't want to move so fast that we spoil an opportunity to do something incredibly meaningful for the region and the region's people. But I'm 100% behind making the case building the program, getting resources to communities so that we can put more roofs over more households' heads. I'm very heartened by this 1, 2, 3 breakdown of approaches. I'm a big fan of step number one, where we buy land, transfer into development, and make it affordable, something we're already doing, something we know something about, it's in our comfort zone and in our existing expertise. And we expand that because maybe not every community has a desire to see new transit-oriented development, has a location that they think needs that, or even believes that in their community it's appropriate to have more governmentally regulated affordability in units. Communities that believe they already have a large supply of so-called naturally occurring housing. And those communities would be benefited by the other strategy that's in item one, which is finding those projects, those developments that need work, and finding a way to get that work done that doesn't raise the rent for every tenant there and maintains affordability in those existing housing units so that dislocation and enforced move-outs don't automatically happen as those projects, as those developments improve in quality. Not adding to the store of low-income housing in a community, if that's the community's concern, but maintaining those units in far better shape. The other two packages of ideas involve more math and science than I got in my undergraduate education, so I'm not going to offer an opinion on them now, but I'm really, really excited about making some direct movement in this area. One of our, I think, ultimately core responsibilities, if we're about having infrastructure for growth and about quality of life, this is right in our so-called wheelhouse. So I'm positive on this stuff.
Councillor Hanson.
First, I want to start with thank you, Councillor Stacey. That was very well put.
Oh,
I'm with him. And I appreciate how eloquent you were about it as well. I can't rise to that occasion, but I'll give you some input from my own words. But first, I need to start with a question. On slide 13 and 14, you mentioned the first time you show the plate, you talk about affordable Todd. Now, I recall that we approved a new version of the Todd strategic plan where we're dealing with equitable Todd, or ETOD for short. And I'm wondering, is ATOD the same as ETOD with just a different name and letter, or are there major differences or nuance differences? Because I don't want to miss it, whatever it is.
I think in this case we're using them.
Works for me. Thanks. Let's move on. Great. So now in my much less eloquent phraseology, this is really important work, and I support it. I'm thrilled that you brought us to this point. You've heard me talk over and over again about the initial steps and this tool and resource, and I've used it so much I wore out my original version of it. But I'm still fully on board with this work, but figuring out how we can go about it in a constructive manner so that we do continue building that trust and get results, but do so in a way that really solves problems. Another way I put it is we feel the challenge together. But solving the challenges, I see us doing it both together, but also with variety, right? That whole use of regional, local, which I think you're touching on beautifully. MPAC engagement there is absolutely necessary, but it's not enough, right? I mean, there's only a few elected officials around that table, and we can't expect, and I know you know this, but we can't expect that communication flow to go all around. So what I want to make sure is that we, as one metro, council and staff together, put together a program that can really work, help us rally around this important need, work on all of these strategies as well. And I think we still have some work to do together on that, and I think it relates to the second question that you were asking us here today. So let's keep going, but I think we're going to have to invest some more time with you as a council to get through some of that. The other part I wanted to mention is, yes, there was the Nature and Natures program, Nature and Neighborhoods program. There was also the local share aspect of the 2006 measure, and I've not seen the analysis yet of the plus and the change, the learnings from that, in order, just on that program alone, so we could take stock of that and then see how we apply it to other programs. But I think that gets a little bit to the variety. The community planning and development grants, now the 2040 grants, have a different system, as do the transportation funding, RFFA resources, and I think that's another aspect that we're going to want to remind ourselves of these models as a council, and then brainstorm what we think politically it might mean for us to engage with our local communities, because we each, while our districts have similar sizes for the districts, we have a different personality and political environment in each of those domains, as well as you've acknowledged, different jurisdictions wanting to solve different aspects of the ecosystem as well. And I think it would help us as the regional council, especially as we move forward with our next major urban growth management cycle, to spend some of our time acknowledging that regionalism is a combination of localisms as well, right? The 27 localisms, meaning the 24 cities and urban areas of three counties. And this could really help us with the vehicle of that. So absolutely stellar work. I've got more to learn and some questions from the great data-rich packet that you've given us that I know we'll be able to follow up on. So thank you very much.
So of our four proposed next steps, program development, political feasibility analysis, racial equity analysis, and engagement strategy, I heard you say...
Oh, all of it.
Okay.
As much as you can, as fast as you can, and as much as we can, and as fast as we can. What that actually means... A little scary. Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Go ahead. I see you. Make your move there.
Go back to your next steps slide here. I this is extremely creative and very impressed. And I want to say thank you. What I really like about it is that it can be tailored to each city in the region, and each city will have different needs, like you described. And so there's something in it for everybody. And I think that it's just outstanding. It's just really well done. I particularly like that you've addressed homelessness. In my part of the region right now, it's a real concern. And I think that would be well accepted, the notion that we're going to be focusing on this in addition to all the other housing needs that we have. So I think it'd be well accepted. Similar to what Councilor Harrington was saying, I mean, I think we need to reach out more than MPAC, and of course we discussed that today on the meeting. But I think we need to be going to individual cities to make sure each city council is really becomes informed, and is really aware of what this is, and not just this high level. And I think the more informed they are, the more accepting they will be, and hopefully they will be our allies as we move to legislature to get the help that we need from the legislature to be able to make this happen.
Sam, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say I really am encouraged, but I mean, I just think it's just such a great step forward, what you presented, and I'm really encouraged with the comments that we've had here today, and just feel really optimistic about it. I think as I think for us to be successful long term, we have to have that community engagement. We have to have the region on board. You never have to have everybody to move something forward, but you have to have to really get momentum. We need those key partners out there, and I agree, it's MPAC is a very important partner. There are many other really critical partners that we can continue to share ideas around. And I think, for me, that investment strategy and that the resource generation questions and really understanding where people are on that and having them understand the range of options and getting that in place is really a great part of this proposal. And so I just thank you for the work that you've done and council for their engagement on this.
And on that, I just want to check when you say, you're all saying, let's talk to people besides the impact. And I assume that you mean not Andy and Emily and me, but you guys will help with that conversation and lead that. And that will be an integrated part of that. And so each of you are saying that in your own way about what your district and your constituents need. But mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that that's what we mean by how we're going to align our work and your work on this.
Yep. Just one metro.
Great.
Shirley, go ahead.
I have a question that I overlooked. Do you feel that some of you met with every housing group / authority in the region? Are they all already been informed about this? I know there's a lot of different ones.
And we met with local city and county staff and housing authorities. So the three housing, Clackamas County Housing Authority, Home Forward, and Portland and Gresham, Multnomah County, and then Washington County Housing Authority. We have not had conversations broader than that because we wanted to have a conversation with the council first. But that is what we would like to do next, is talking to affordable developers, the nonprofits, the broader range of the service providers, broader range groups that are working on this issue.
Home builders, I would assume, to get them informed early on,
private developers, and nonprofits.
I would throw in with everybody else. I think it's a great proposal that you put together for us. And obviously there is work, and fortunately there's enough work for us as well as you. We would hate to be cut out of that whole process and not have the opportunity to go out and have a discussion with our colleagues around the region. And I think I heard everybody commit to basically to helping you do that. So we will make sure that begins to happen. The other thing that I picked up as we were going through, and I think Councillor Stacey's point was well put. I think that this is a problem that's going to be with us for a long, long time. It may, in fact, and we're not sure, be endemic to the kind of land use planning that we do in the Portland region. It is conceivable that that creating an urban growth boundary puts additional upward price pressure on housing. And therefore, it is very appropriate for us to take a look at how to relieve that upward pressure, if not just the regular pressure that growth creates, as a way of making sure that we can, in some respects, have our cake and eat it too, which is to derive the benefits of a tight urban form in terms of the preservation of farm and forest land, and at the same time not price lower-income people out of the region that we've helped to create because it's such a desirable place to live. And I think it is therefore appropriate for us to take this task on. And I like the model, but I think, having started down that line, I almost forgot my train of thought there, that it's going to be with us for a while. So speed is not the important component here, as much as thoroughness and the collaborative, developing that collaborative atmosphere. This is not an issue we're going to solve overnight. It's not an issue that we're going to solve particularly quickly, and we aren't going to solve it at all if we don't have support from the vast majority of the local partners. out there in the region, particularly the local governments, but also including all of those folks who have a stake in the housing industry, for the full gamut of the housing industry, and all of those folks who have responsibility for caring for the people in our community who are of lower income. I'm thinking in terms of organizations like Community Action and some of the groups that, you know, we don't have a consistent model around the region for how we deliver those services either. And so it takes a little, you know, Multnomah County does it slightly differently than Washington County, and they do it slightly differently than Clackamas County. And so there are people in that bailiwick that probably need to be brought on board, and I think will be great sources of support for whatever it is we want to do. I got a feeling, nagging feeling, that this is going to require more revenue than we have in a normal year of doing work. And so I think we need to have some discussion about a revenue source. The simplest, I think most straightforward politically and legally, is a general obligation bond. Whether that's the best way or not, I'm not sure. And I've been noodling a little bit around a concept that I picked up in reading one of Michael Bloomberg's newest books about capturing the value that is the value in land, the increase in the value of land that takes place when you have some sort of infrastructure development or other kinds of development. And of course, we've experienced that in the form of TIF. Financing. And the rules around TIF are very carefully structured under state law, so this is not something that you just leap out and do. It's something we would have to contemplate, perhaps a change in state law that would allow us to do it. But I think if there was some way that we can tie funding to growth in assessed value, which is 3% a year, even if you only limited that to the amount that our levy applies to the total assessed value of the region, that you would then begin to develop a pot of money that you might then be able to tie into a TOD-like program, expand the TOD program to do the kinds of things we're talking about. I don't know. It would be interesting to look at how much money something like that would raise. It would be interesting to look at the plethora of legal things we would have to do in order to make that possible. But again, if we take the time to look at those kinds of solutions, it seems to me that we will have a more permanent solution than if we simply say, well, we know what we can do, let's do that and get this done quickly and then move on to something else. More polar bears would be that's what I vote for. But anyway, so I think that as part of that discussion, it might be good, and that's a clearly not very well formed idea, but that's why I like you guys. You all form those. You form those ideas for us, and and I'm sure we could. Allison could tell us 15 different ways why we can't do it.
That's not my job.
I know.
Well, no, she tells us how to do it and to do it legally.
Well, what I think is identifying the ways that we can't, the reasons we can't do it, also gives us
the
strategy for how we address the legislature and figure out how we can get the tools that we need. But anyway,
in some ways, strategy number one of land acquisition is kind of the reverse of the TIF idea. If you combine it with and get it early in a transit project, you're purchasing land before the price has gone up, before adjudication occurs. Mm-hmm. So you're capturing a lower value prior to the public investment. So in some ways, you're trying to do the reverse of that. I think you did have on your list a couple value capture mechanisms. We'll continue to explore, but there are challenges around a lot of those, in particular tax sector finance, a lot of that's capped out in various areas. But we can look at some of that briefly.
Don't we have some restrictions also, though, in terms of purchasing land and then selling it for a profit? And is that
there are some, depending on what type of bonds we purchase with. But there's also revenue bonds.
And like there's no arbitrage.
For tax issues, the problem value. Of selling. So financial research is definitely part of the next level of further that research. Well, how would we do what we would do most efficiently and effectively? So it sounds like we have some guidance on what to research.
Go ahead, Shirley.
Well, I just wondered, I took from what you were saying that you think that might be the more simple way to call it simple. But what about the CET, though? I think that, I know we need to get legislative approval, but in some ways I think that would even be easier. But I don't know.
The issue with that is that it might raise about $10 million a year.
Oh, not enough. It's the amount of money.
They have more flexibility than a bond measure because we spend on programmatic activities, so it has a benefit. But they all have challenges, and they will be viewed differently by different partners. I think part of our next set of work is to explore some of those questions.
We have all of the above. Guess it won't.
Go ahead, Catherine.
So did we touch on the nature of questions and discussion that we were hoping for today? You got your direction? And
as we said at the beginning, we don't have to solve the region's problems today, but we have to continue to take steps toward figuring out how Metro can add value. And it seems that we all agree that everything that we have presented is worth considering further rather than taking anything off the table at this point that is not worthy of further consideration. So the programmatic elements that we presented all seem like things that seem to be a good fit and should be developed further. The financial tools with some good feedback about other strategies should be developed further. Engaging partners beyond the local government staff to staff, so recognizing that we're going to do a little bit broader of an engagement strategy. There are obviously people in this room who are quite interested in the next steps that we are going to do around engagement. So recognizing that we're all going to engage together starting next week at MPAC, and then really diving in a little bit more, making sure we understand which of these strategies and tools will have the best impact on our racial equity outcomes as well. So it seems like there's nothing here that you want us to go a different direction, but that we're all going to go in the direction together.
Yep.
So you'll be hearing more soon.
Go in every direction at once.
And prosper.
And by the way, yeah, you've got a planning department. What else would you do? The polar bears will come later. But if we solve all of the Regis problems today, then you all can take tomorrow off. it's an interesting prospect, right? Any further discussion on this topic? All right. Go ahead, Craig.
We're good.
So let's move to council liaison updates and council communication. Go ahead, Craig.
I would like to share that while we were on recess, I did do something that was a little bit interesting. I was invited by the Hawaiian Clean Energy Forum to come and speak at their annual Clean Energy Day, which this year was entitled Clean Energy and Transportation. And so they were looking for someone. They spoke to Transportation for America and asked if there was someone who would speak on the topic, and they recommended me. And they agreed, so invited me to come over and speak with them on that. And I spent a lot of the day listening to what they were talking about. A lot of their concerns are around where their fuel comes from. They're very dependent on oil. Not only about 73% of the oil, the petroleum that's used in Hawaii is transportation related, and the rest is that's how they generate their electricity. So they burn oil to generate electricity. So they're looking at ways to get away from that. And the state of Hawaii actually has a stated goal of being energy independent away from fossil fuels by, I think, 2050. But they literally have no plan on how to achieve that.
Well, they do have some wind energy now.
There is some, yes.
I mean, I don't want people to think it's zero.
No, there are other ways, but it's pretty small at this point. We'll see. There's not a lot of political will to do a lot more of that. After listening to what they had to say and talking to them about what we've done here in Portland, which is what I spent a lot of the time doing, I realized that they had little concept of what we talked about as the link between land use and transportation, and how you can reduce commute distances and reduce congestion through the jobs and housing balance, and reducing VMT through effective land use planning. And so I really spoke on that, and I felt like by the end of the day, I was hearing them reflect that back, saying, oh, I recognize that that's a need and a value. So at that point, I threw up my hands in the air and said, my work here is
success.
Yeah. Oahu is interesting. Oahu is about this island of Oahu is about the same size as metropolitan Portland. But they only have two-thirds of the population we do. They're topping over just 1 million people on the island. As a result, a lot more of it is rural than we have. And they do have zoning limits that limits urban development. Their government structure is interesting. Oahu is a county, and it's also a city. There is no county commission. The mayor of Honolulu is the head of the administration for the entire island. There are separate identified cities that exist as municipal entities. They're all part of greater Honolulu, which is interesting. But there are some things that they could do. Surprisingly, they were complaining about the large number of cars. And there's almost more cars than people on the island, particularly when you consider the large number. Well, if you think about in terms of permanent residents, because there's so many rental cars, at any given moment, there's somewhere between 100 and 150,000 tourists on the island. But their gas taxes are low. Hawaii's gas tax, the state gas tax, is about 17 cents a gallon.
Wow.
And then Honolulu has its own, which is almost equivalent at 16 and a half cents a gallon. But their gas prices are about the same as ours, or actually slightly lower than what's in the Portland metro area. My own vision as I was going around the city. Average gas price for regulars about $2.45 a gallon or so. So they're not doing much to encourage people to use something other than gasoline. So they've got lots of things that they can do, but they're identifying that to get people away from fossil fuel use, their choices are electric. They're recognizing the value of electric cars. And also hydrogen-powered cars. But then how do you generate the electricity, or how do you generate the hydrogen from what you have to replace that? And listening to that, I heard people suggest, well, we should just pass a law saying that by a certain date, all private vehicles have to be non-internal combustion, non-gasoline power. And so they asked me to do a summary at the end of the day, and I said, well, I have a big question for you. Is that how are you going to create that turnover in the fleet, the state fleet of cars, faster than the market would allow? Because for every person that said, well, we should just, say that that's the way it's going to be, then we would have a counter, basically, typically from elected officials in the room saying, yeah, that's not going to happen. We're not just going to pass a law saying you can't have a gasoline-powered car after a certain time. So I left them kind of with that question. If that's your goal, how are you going to achieve that goal? It was an interesting conversation, I feel like their response to me at the end was they felt like they got some value out of what I had to say. And left on very good terms. Actually got drugged back after I was supposed to be released and invited to go on and be interviewed live on a television program with regard to what we'd done in the conference that day. And so I think they liked what I had to say. And I wasn't the only person. They had a gentleman there, another featured speaker that was from Wisconsin, also talking about performance measures. which was a valuable conversation as well. But it's great to see these folks addressing their big challenge head on. And, you know, we talk about the transportation housing cost balance. We think our housing here is expensive. On the island of Oahu, the littlest shack with any kind of amenities at all is like $1 million or more. And housing costs are a huge challenge for the vast majority of people who live there because of the nature of their economy. So many of their jobs are service jobs that aren't real high paying. And they've got really big challenges that make ours look almost small by comparison when you look at those kinds of challenges on how to deal with housing costs and transportation.
One of the mayor of Honolulu's top advisors is Pat Rebellia's daughter.
Oh, is really?
Yeah,
really
he's
good.
Sure.
Sure. Surely,
thank you. This morning was the quarterly Intertwined Alliance Board of Directors meeting, and I attend as many as I can. They meet 4 times a year. But I was pleased to listen to the discussion because they're beginning to move in a direction that I think will really be beneficial for us. They recognize that if we want to achieve our goal of interconnected parks and trails and natural areas, we need to, of course, get the community more mobilized and to help us more with this. And so they're moving toward a direction to begin to consider hiring someone that might be able to help them with this and begin to work with electeds. And my perspective as a liaison to the board, that's been a missing link. I've been the only elected on that board, and I'm just a liaison. I'm not an official board member. And so it's really been staff talking to staff over the last few years. And so they're moving forward to begin to think about hiring someone that can really begin to create that link and engage the cities and the counties and jurisdictions in this discussion. So I was really pleased to hear this. They actually have someone in mind that they might even hire who happens to also be an elected. So the challenge, though, is money. The revenue, their income, the revenue is really actually going down as opposed to going up. A few of their large contributors, partners that they've had, have stepped out. Some of those are from the sports industry are not as involved now, and so that it's making so that Mike Wetter's having on one side trying to raise money to keep the organization afloat, but not only raise money to keep neutral revenue, but to raise additional revenue to be able to hire another person. So they were discussing options for that, how they would figure out how to have enough revenue available, income to be able to do all that they want to do. But I'm pleased they're heading in the right direction, but the financial end is going to be still a limiting factor.
I have a few things. I followed up on Ellen Ito's invitation to us to work a minimum 4-hour shift at the Oregon Zoo food and beverage part of the business. It was very interesting, a very good use of my time. I was provided with a tour of all the food and bev facilities, learned a lot about their current scheduling tool, historic tools, so what the available shifts are, how they're provided to deal with the individual employees' needs as well, but how the system works and is available to employees. Saw the break room, spent time there, learned a heck of a lot about staff levels, got to see in action the daily staff handling, the staff flexibility provided for in the schedule to really every single employee has their own individual circumstances there that are economy accommodated. It's interesting. But also the flexibility that goes in and how it's all used every single hour the day the zoo is open. I worked the Cascade Grill busing tables, and then I also worked at the Elephant Ear cart that was open that day and managed to not hurt myself, which was really good. Another thing that occurred while we were on recess was the City of Beaverton had a transportation symposium for their employees and their direct electeds, and it was really fascinating. I was only able to attend 2 hours of it, learned a lot. Really great outside speakers, had about a dozen takeaways about readiness, their decisions we need to make today about technological use, using open solutions, technology as an opportunity to serve community needs, so really making sure you know what community problem you're trying to solve and what the community benefit is. Do smaller scale deployments and do them rapidly, so fast turn versus doing this big monster, large scale, because technology changes on a rapid basis and the investments are really 2-year deployments. We need to put a lot more tolerance into our procurement systems. That is an identified roadblock in public agency work right now for this kind of progress. They spent time making sure that we understood that connected vehicles and autonomous vehicles are separate concepts, that technology like this can be used in our communities so that the legal consequences of bad actors is really felt. You know, right now if a person gets hit by a car, it's that victim feels the consequences, and the person behind the wheel doesn't necessarily get a fine or a ticket, or their insurance doesn't necessarily go up. So shifting those consequences, that the cities need to work together to define standards, and there's real opportunity there. Different deployment rates by form factors, whether you're a truck, a car, on a bicycle, or a walking person, is really great. I hadn't thought about that. And that shared mobility, shared makes mobility more affordable, particularly for older community members, disabled, under 16, and low income. And that rollout models can be done for central city, suburban city, and rural. So it's like, cool. And mobility may be the next digital divide issue, which is a little scary. But and how Vision Zero can help with this adoption versus people fearing the adoption of autonomous vehicles or connected vehicles. And then lastly, today I finally followed up on my April trip to Japan on resilience and had a lunch and learn. 5 of us were there, but I think we did good. We exhibited good behavior and didn't break any quorum rules, but we also had a nice group of staff there as well. But we had a bit of discussion about what might we need to do next as a Metro Council and just brainstorming some ideas. So no deliberation, but I know it was fun.
That's right. I probably shouldn't have asked the question that
directly. No, it's okay. It's okay. We
didn't try to answer it. That's
no, right. No. Pondering it, and we talked
about it. By the time you asked it, I'd already left. So I get, but there were
still four.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't make any decisions.
You don't need me for a quorum.
Didn't vote on
anything.
Nope. That was it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good job, by the way. Bob.
Thank you. Wednesday of last week, I represented Metro at the Portland City Council. As the council took action to formally accept a Nature and Neighborhoods grant of $1 million from Metro, which we issued in 2014, and they're just now getting around to allocating that money for the next stage of Gateway Green, which most of you, I'm sure, have heard about the off-road cycling facility and park between I-205 and I-84, next to Rocky Butte, which was long an island of largely inaccessible island, former site of the Multnomah County Jail. Some of us were old enough to remember that building.
Rocky Butte.
Yeah. And a great occasion to once again thank Linda Robinson, who's the...
Linda Robinson?
Yeah, the community leader who has been advocating for that for more than a decade.
Yeah.
And then today, Councilor Dirksen and I, in our role as liaisons for the Southwest Corridor Project, we've got a briefing and update from staff in preparation for our next upcoming meeting of the steering committee, and an identification of an item that should, with the consent of the president, come out as a consent item on the September 28th calendar. Under the land use final order process, the process has been used for every, at least in the last two decades, light rail project. The legislature once again authorized the use of a LUFO for Southwest Corridor. Under a land use final order, rather than each individual government with land use authority in the corridor making determinations about whether their zoning code or comprehensive plan is adequately implemented by a decision affecting the corridor, that gets made in one omnibus review by a committee that makes a recommendation to the Metro Council, and the Metro Council then discharges the responsibility of deciding yes or no whether it meets the applicable criteria. Those criteria will be adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission under the statute. And along the way, we will, that's what consent item is for, we are directed to establish a steering committee that would make a recommendation to us on the siting. That steering committee has to be composed of representatives of each of the governments in the corridor. It'll be almost accomplishable simply by holding a meeting of most of the members of the steering committee for the project, but we need to add Multnomah County. We can excuse governmental officials who don't have land in the corridor, such as Eddie Doyle from Beaverton, but that would come to us as a consent item statutorily. We do this. We want to take advantage of the land use final order process, and it's one that shouldn't involve any policy decision-making until we're faced with the question, do these findings conform to the LCDC criteria?
Okay. Shirley?
Thank you. I overlooked. Tomorrow is the 13th Annual Voyage of the Visionaries. This is the annual policymakers bike ride. Is anybody else participating?
I typically do. I'm not going to be able to because the ODOT
he's going to Hawaii.
Transportation Policy Board is also meeting tomorrow, and I need to go to that. And so I can't figure out the logistics to be able to go.
Take your bike to
both. This year they're taking both the Green Loop and the Lentz Green Ring. So it'll be the Green Loop that Port City of Portland's planning, and then we'll venture out into the Lentz area. Mm-hmm. So I'll be participating, but I have a new electric bicycle, so I'm going to make sure.
Oh,
awesome.
You can borrow mine if you like.
Oh, this is why all of you.
I'll get it out.
Sam.
Just quickly, the Institute for Metropolitan Studies met this morning and talked about a number of things and did a reunion of some old members of that, Council of Liberty and others. The one thing I thought I'd mention is there was I think they were let down that they didn't get this grant to support the Southwest Equitable Development Committee's work with their analysis and some economic analysis. Eco Northwest got the contract. I think the general feeling was, and I was not involved.
Me neither.
Yeah. But I think the general feeling was that theirs was a kind of more reflective of what of evaluating what might happen there, whereas the Eco Northwest was really going to be giving information that would help the decision making in the process. So I just encouraged Sheila was interested in talking and learning a little more about the process, and is there some role that would make sense for them? So I said that sounds like a good idea to talk to staff about that. But I thought the general framework for why the Eastern Northwest contract was selected sounded like a pretty good rationale. And then follow up was a pretty impassioned conversation about the corridor and the concerns around equity, which is something that there may be some opportunity to
for me to share back how things are progressing there, what places for them to plug into that process. So if that happens, I'd be interested in sharing that back with them. And then the Merck met yesterday, and Travel Portland did a longer kind of update on how things are going. A couple things they're dealing with. One is really the reaction of national reaction to some of the white supremacist advancements that have happened here in Portland more recently, including the TriMet incident. It's probably understating that. So they're really doing a lot of work to engage people about the diversity of our city and incorporating diverse communities in that process. So that's moving forward. And then every year or every quarter we see these charts where we're just knocking it out of the park. Beating the records from the most phenomenal record beating, the quarter before. So it's really encouraging. This time it was more of we're sort of sustaining this amazing level of occupancy and high room rates. I actually think it's kind of a positive thing that we're adding hotel rooms and we're still sustaining that high level. I'd rather see that than just a continued, cost increase where people can't come to our city.
Right.
So I thought it was pretty encouraging, even though it wasn't the normal, beating the previous quarters, the record of all records.
Can I ask a question? Regarding the PSCs, the Metropolitan Institute, do they apply for a CET grant? When you said the funding, what were you referring to? What funding?
There was a contract RFP for something. Scott could, some others could talk about it. It was a Southwest Corridor, some work to support the Southwest Equity
Development
Strategy.
Equitable housing. Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't know which funding source you were referring to.
Great. Well, I wanted to share that if there is data available that they can be provided with regard to evaluations that have been done in the Southwest Corridor about the presence of at-risk communities that would be at risk of gentrification if certain things happen. Also identifying what affordable housing is available in the region and what the opportunities for that would be. Some of that has already been gathered as part of the process that we've gone through, that would be accessible to them, I'm sure. And then finally, I just wanted to, just for the record, because of my comments about my trip, I wanted to, for the record, point out that all the expenses are being paid by the Clean Energy Forum.
Okay.
And then in all the time I was there, actually had 1 2-hour opportunity to lay by the pool.
I would just mention in passing that on Sunday, and I'm a little confused about the location because we had I've got it on my schedule as Terry Shrunk Plaza, but I think it's going to be Holiday Park, the rally.
I believe it's Holiday Park.
I think it's Holiday Park. There's going to be a rally against white nationalism that the city of Portland, I think, is kind of organizing and has invited us to participate in if we'd like to. So if you've got time at 12:30 on Sunday afternoon, join us in
this weekend.
Holiday Park for a rally against white supremacy.
Is it a counter-protest? Are they planning on protesting?
I think the idea, at least as I understand it, and I've been telling my wife this, so she'll let me out of the house, it's to have it over here as opposed to the white nationalist rally, which is over there, so that it won't be a face-to-face kind of confrontation thing. It will be
over. Everyone will agree to that.
Yeah, I think that would. So anyway, that's why it's at Holiday Park. Anyway, anything else for the good of the order? All righty then, we're going to be adjourned.